from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, wherever you are listening. Welcome to the very last rated LGBT radio show of 2018. We took maybe 2 weeks off this year, so this is likely to, I haven't actually counted, but I'm going to guess that this is our 50th show of the year. Last week, we reviewed the first half of the year of the shows we've done, the topics we covered, the high points, the low points, the touching points, the moving points, and everything in between. And tonight we pick up where we left off, and we are going to talk about the latter part of the year. And we had an equal amount of really poignant, right on target shows. Some that blew my mind, hope they blew yours as well. At this point, I want to welcome on my co-host and one of our show producers, Brody Levesque. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob, good evening, and good evening to our listeners. I only have a couple of news items, but I think these are fairly important. The first one comes from our good friend Zach Ford at Sync Progress. Zach is the LGBT editor there, and you can always access them at thinkprogress.org. An app encouraging users that encourages them to recover from same-sex attractions through prayer continues to be accessible on Google and Amazon's platforms, and this is days after Apple removed it from the Apple Store. Living Hope Ministries is a Texas-based organization that claims to support, quote, those who are seeking sexual and relational wholeness through a more intimate relationship with Jesus Christ, end quote. In short, they're preaching that people can and should pray the gay away, despite ample evidence that sexual orientation is innate and cannot be changed, and furthermore, that attempts to change it are harmful. This was brought about, the app was available on the App Store with Apple for about 3 years, and my good friend, Wayne Besson, who is the CEO of Truth Wins Out, which is an organization that campaigns against conversion therapy or anything that even smells like conversion therapy, had launched a petition against the app last week, and Apple very quickly yanked it. So kudos to Apple. Wayne and the folks at Truth Wins Out are hoping that the executives at Google and Amazon will consider also removing the app from the store, and with any luck at all, maybe they'll get someplace in 2019 with that. Another story, ironically enough, coming out of Texas. Judge Reed O'Connor, the Texas judge who last week struck down the Affordable Care Act, has been given a green light on a lawsuit that could have profound implications for transgender patients and those seeking an abortion. The suit was brought against the Department of Health and Human Services by 8 states, a religious hospital network, and an association of Christian healthcare professionals. They're all taking aim at the Obama-era rule that was issued by Health and Human Services in 2016 that interprets sex discrimination in Section 1557 of the law, or the Affordable Care Act, to include discrimination on the basis of gender identity and termination of pregnancy. The rule requires plaintiffs to perform and provide insurance coverage for gender transitions and abortions contrary to their religious and beliefs and medical judgment, according to the filing. Now, here's the problem with this.
Could you explain that in one more layman's term concepts? I'm not quite following what that suit's about.
Well, basically, you've got 8 states, okay, and religious hospitals and some Christian healthcare professionals that are going after a particular rule that prevents them from discriminating based on gender transition and abortions. In other words, this is more of the religious, you know, freedoms and beliefs nonsense that's being put forward. If this judge, which is what I was just getting ready to explain, if the judge decides, okay, in favor for these plaintiffs, then that means that they could discriminate basically on transgender transition surgery and transistor, the hormone therapy or any of that, based on their, you know, religious beliefs. And, you know, that's a problem. It also goes out that it would restrict abortion considerably. Now, it also signals a much larger issue, and I'll continue with NBC's coverage on it. Proponents of the rule say that it will counter fines in favor of the plaintiffs. It would signal to insurers and providers that they can refuse to cover or provide care related to gender transitions and abortions and gut the ability of the Office of Civil Rights and Health and Human Services to investigate discrimination claims made by anyone seeking those services. The ruling in this case also has the potential to influence how other courts interpret the meaning of sex discrimination. Jillian Brandstetter, who is the spokesperson for the National Center for Transgender Equality, who works for MARA, my friend Mark Kiesling, who's the executive director of that organization, made the following quote. The regulation in question helps to ensure nearly 2 million transgender people have access to life-saving care, she said, and then continuing, we believe very strongly rescinding this guidance could do substantial harm to the progress made with providers and insurance to the detriment of trans well-being and trans rights. And then, of course, the other flip of this is that once again, it's the same old fight as another chipping away at Roe v. Wade. So those are kind of the top two LGBTQ stories I've been watching today. Most everything else, obviously, has been related to our dear friend in the White House and some of his shenanigans. He can't even go to Iraq without causing controversy. So, you know, that's been my day all day, Rob.
Right. And now, Brody, you were watching the White House carefully, as you do, from your journalistic standpoint. And while he was secretly on his way to the war zone for a surprise visit, you actually figured it out before anybody else. How did you do that?
Well, I wasn't the only one that did it. What happened was a member of an airplane spotting club in the United Kingdom sent a friend of mine at The Guardian a posting. In this particular posting was a picture of an aircraft, and my friend at The Guardian said, isn't this the Air Force One? And, it was obviously taken at a distance, but it was very recognizable as being one of the two VC-25 aircraft that the Special Air Missions at Andrews Air Force Base use in support of presidential transportation. So, yeah, it was one of the two Air Force Ones. And so here's the story, and then CNN ran it today. The man was in his kitchen in England. He was looking out his window. He saw a contrail, and then realizing it was an aircraft, and he's a plane spotter, he goes out, takes a picture of it. It's recognizable in this picture as Air Force One. And one of my and it was using a call sign, because they have little groups that do this, RCH-358, which is shorthand for Air Force call sign Reach 358, which is normally a designated cargo aircraft. And, of course, obviously, this big blue and white aircraft is not cargo. And then one of my editors in Paris got a hold of me and said, we've got, you know, people saying that they just saw Air Force One over Europe. And I'm like, well, yeah. And what was even more interesting was the fact that someone had asked, well, you know, the Marine Guard hasn't been outside the entrance of the West Wing. And he's been awfully quiet on Twitter. So I went back to his Twitter feed, and, yeah, there had been nothing since the night before. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if Alan Melloy in England gets a pretty damn good picture of obviously one of the presidential aircraft, Trump hasn't been on Twitter since, you know, late last night. There's no Marine Guard outside the entrance to the West Wing. And then we had gotten notices from the Media Affairs and Press Office that there was a lid, meaning no coverage, on the West Wing until after lunchtime. And, you know, look, I've been around the zoo a few times, and I've taken one of those unannounced trips, and all I could think was, he's on his way to a war zone, or he's on his way someplace he doesn't want anybody to know about. And about 2 hours after that, we get the news, oh, he's in Iraq. And I'm like, and this guy in England out of his secret trip, I'm like laughing my butt off. And it's just one of those things where, you know, no matter what you do to be secret, there's, you know, this is the most recognizable aircraft paint scheme in the world. And there's only two birds, okay, because they're identical, SAM 28,000 and SAM 29,000, you know, and they're the only planes I could think of painted that way. So I just found it was amusing. Actually, I put it up on my Facebook page because I thought it was pretty hysterical. But, his little sneaking around, it wasn't that big of a sneak, actually. So, the thing is, Rob, that's this year. Haven't you noticed? In the stories we've been covering, you know?
Well, I have to say, compared to the rest of the year, for him, this was actually kind of a classy move. I mean, comparatively speaking.
Started off that way, but he didn't quite end up that way because while he was in Iraq, he managed to violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice with his stupid, you know, MAGA hats because, you know, politicking and military in uniform is an absolute no-no. And yet he's sitting there as commander-in-chief, okay, signing those hats, you know. He takes group pictures with everyone, including the entire SEAL team. Now, this is not something that you put out on Twitter. You know, it's just practice not to do that, you know. And so the entire SEAL team got outed. It's like, seriously? And then, you know, to pour more petrol on the fire, he turns it into a bloody political rally and sits there and slams the Democrats. But another journalist made an interesting point to me because we were discussing this. If you look at the military personnel in Iraq, they weren't taking selfies and pictures with the commander-in-chief. They were taking selfies and pictures, okay, with the reality star from The Apprentice.
Right.
Because you could tell. Maybe there were a few diehard Trump supporters in uniform there, but I think the vast majority of them were like, hey, you know, this is the apprentice guy, you know, the you're fired guy. He happens to be, you know, president of the United States, it was surreal. It really, Rob, it seriously was surreal.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't fault them. I mean, I don't know if I would say anybody would be so overlooking the fact that he had won the presidency in the interim between The Apprentice. But, you know, there is this huge historical figure right there, you know, in their midst. So to take a picture with them is, you know, an opportunity, you know, period. So I don't fault anybody for being excited about that. And, you know, it's like anybody making that gesture to be there, even in the completely inept way he would do things. I can understand their enthusiasm. How do you think the shutdown is going to play out? Who's going to be the winner and losers off of that?
As you and I are on the air now, I'm literally on the East Coast, and in just under 2 hours, another part of the executive branch of government, the Environmental Protection Agency, will be closing down because they run out of money at midnight tonight. The entire United States Coast Guard, all 45,000 service members, are working without pay. which is not true of the rest of the five branches, I mean the other four branches of the military, but the Coast Guard, because they're under Homeland Security, you've got the entire Coast Guard not getting paid. I will also note that Borders and Customs Protection agents aren't getting paid, neither is ICE. Anybody in Homeland Security basically isn't getting a paycheck. And another 6,500 critical need employees for the Coast Guard have been furloughed. It also didn't help today that, you know, he went rage-tweeting, blaming it all on Democrats. And then the thing that really struck me was he sat there and said, well, shutdown doesn't matter because most of the people who are federal workers affected are Democrats. Okay. Now, I have been listening to federal workers all day long, okay? And I'll tell you what, I'll keep it very family-friendly for our show here because what I heard today, okay, quite frankly, is not printable, all right? He really is not in a good way with the federal workforce. And here's the thing. We got the polling numbers back about, I'd say, probably close to 25 minutes before you and I went on air. And we are now looking at a full 47% of the American population blaming him, registered voter-wise, okay, for the shutdown. And again, it's all over the wall. He is literally, as Senator right. Schumer of New York said, throwing a temper tantrum. And I'll be honest with you, it's not playing well. And, you know, you've got, for all intents and purposes, within the margin of error, half the country is blaming him for the shutdown. And here's the thing. It's going to continue to get more painful. And now the Senate adjourned. So nothing's going to happen until after January 3rd when the 117th Congress sits and goes into session. So the Senate's now completely adjourned. So you've got no lawmakers in Washington at all whatsoever. And, you know, the Democrats are digging in. Congressman Ted Lau of Los Angeles threw out a bunch of tweets today, some which I thought were great in a major shade, you know, pointing out the fact that, you know, this is now beyond ludicrous. And I think it's also, you know, sending a warning to the Republican leadership in the Senate, because the Democrats will have, you know, full control of the House, that the Democrats are done. They've had enough. And I think the Republicans are going to find themselves in a really bad way. Now, there's some diehards over there, you know, like Lindsey Graham and, you know, McConnell and Corman mm-hmm. of Texas, you know, some of them. But, I mean, you know, the American public, I think, is getting to the point where the minority of base support for Trump, they're going to find themselves, you know, basically being, you know, metaphorically tarred and feathered by their fellow citizens because their fellow citizens are pretty much at it, too. I mean, if you look at the damage this guy has done in less than 3 years, it's pretty severe. He's disrupted and destroyed, you know. He is literally, I can say this 100% because I have reported on five different administrations, and I'm a historian in addition to being a journalist. He has dynamited the presidency of the United States, okay? And he just didn't do it domestically. The United States is, for all intents and purposes now, okay, with the disparity between those who have and those that have not, Trump in the White House, Trump's policies, the nonsense going on in the world, the misuse of, you know, American assets, this thing on the border, violations of, you know, the civil rights and the human rights of, you know, the people, you know, coming across the border asking for political asylum. You know, there's a laundry list here. The United States has turned into a very dangerous third world country that's nuclear armed. And that's not a good place to be.
No. And I want to switch to one other thing that came out today and get your feedback on it. And that is the report that Michael Cohen, there's now evidence that he actually was in Prague. And this is something that has come up in the investigation.
My colleagues at McClatchy are just what a brilliant bit of investigative journalism. There was, as you know, a dossier written by a British intelligence officer. It's known as the Steele dossier, named after the gentleman who wrote it. And it had been poo-pooed and bandied about as being the work of science fiction because some of the things that were in there were, you know, hey, a little graphic, a little weird. But a couple of the things that was in the dossier pointed at the fact that Cohen had supposedly had meetings with the Russians in Europe in 2016 during the course of the presidential campaign. Now, McClatchy and their folks were able to put things together, and a mobile telephone belonging to Cohen was pinged by a tower briefly near Prague in the Czech Republic. Now, assuming that Mr. Cohen doesn't leave his mobile behind anywhere, that means that Mr. Cohen and his mobile were in the Czech Republic. And the meetings that were alleged to have taken place, or at least one of them, were thought to have taken place in Prague. So it's really a case of, you know, putting 2 + 2 = 4. That was just some really, I thought, fantastic journalism. But what it really does is it goes to the point that it shows you, okay, that all these allegations and everything that's going on, it doesn't matter how many times, you know, Trump sits there and says no collusion. At the end of the day, there's some pretty rotten things that have been going on since, you know, since the campaign. But I have said this before to you privately off the air. I've said it publicly. Donald Trump is a mafia chieftain. That's it. And I mean, he's not a very bright one. Okay. And his entire organization is corrupt. You know, his family is corrupt. I mean, the revelation was made earlier in the week by NBC that the daughters of the physician that got him on a draft deferment stated unequivocally there's no bone spurs. It was another lie that was made up, and that their father, the physician, did it as a favor to Fred Trump, Donald's, you know, father. So, I mean, there's a lifelong pattern of corruption and criminal acts, or, you know, what could be loosely termed or looked at as criminal acts by this person. And, you know, if anybody was expecting it to suddenly stop and he'd get in the White House and clean his act up, yeah, okay. I have a bridge I want to sell you in the middle of the desert.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah. McClatchy did a really good job with that one. So, yeah, that was the Cohen thing today.
So, yeah, so interesting thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just, I mean, it just goes to the one thing that I don't think the Americans have taken very seriously, and they've been very complacent about, and that is how fragile their democracy and their so-called republic really, honestly, truly is. And the checks and balances to stop things like this have been badly damaged in the Trump era. You know, when I was in high school, the checks and balances against an equally corrupt president, Richard Nixon, was my profession. And especially with the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune. I mean, it was the press, CBS News. It literally was the press. And the Washington Post has to get a lion's share of the credit because of the incredible job that Mrs. Graham and Ben Bradley and the reporters and the editors of the Post did. And stopping, quite frankly, the nonsense that was the Nixon White House. The problem is that, you know, a lot of things have happened in the 40-some plus years since then that have kind of chipped away at that. And as you know, my profession is now constantly under attack. And in many cases, we haven't helped our cause because of, quite frankly, the the atmosphere in what I loosely term corporate media is we don't help our own case there with that. And it doesn't also
right.
help when you have a demagoguery moron, filled moron sitting in the White House doing what he's been doing, screaming fake news, this, that, and that thing, and getting the population with that. So it's tenuous at best. And I'm going to say this for the record. I think the other problem here is that the former men who are still alive who held that office have done the American nation a huge and massive disservice. I think that Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, okay, suck. And the reason they suck is because every one of them held that job. Everyone knows what goes on in that job. And they should have been screaming from pulpits, rooftops, grabbing cameras, and anything and everything in their power to let the American people just how much damage this idiot is doing to the American democracy. And they didn't do it. They finally, Obama finally came around a little bit, but it's everybody's pulled their punches. This is a dangerous time. This is not a time to pull your punches. The only former president of the United States, that I have seen, say what has needed to be said is that 93-year-old gentleman peanut farmer from Georgia. President Carter has said what the others need to do, but Obama and Bush should have been on Ellen. They should have been on The Late Show. They should have been out in front of cameras whipping up Republicans and Democrats both. This is a bipartisan issue. There is a danger to the democracy. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to blame the idiots that sat in that office, and know full well. And if there's anybody out there that doesn't like that, I don't care. Because they're at fault.
Well,
this is
okay,
someone who can destroy the republic.
Well,
anyway.
I think he can damage the United States, absolutely. And unfortunately, the voice is strong about him doing that. I mean, I don't think a lot of people in the country. Either you've got the half of the country that doesn't believe it because there is this China wall between the two sides of media, one being Fox News and the other being everyone else. And and if you live in the Fox News side of the house, there is a whole other narrative going on and always has been. And that has gone on for years. That these two medias have been allowed to coexist without really challenging each other. They point fingers over the wall and they talk about what the other one is saying, but of course, when they present what the other one's saying, they don't present what is actually being said. But the other piece of this is that there is a flaw in the republic and the democracy, quote unquote. Because if anything has been proven is that we are so far away from a democracy, and it has nothing to do with Donald Trump. All Donald Trump did was make it evident that we are so far away from it. I live in California. California has been left out of this, period. We are the fourth largest or fifth largest economy in the world, and we have not had a say in who is running this country, period. We had millions of people well and above push Hillary Clinton above the 50% mark in the popular vote to absolutely no effect. The votes were there. The problem is California votes don't count. And that has to do with the Electoral College, which was built for the slave era of the United States. That's the problem. And gerrymandering, which has been allowed to be done across the country, which in a miracle did not stop the midterms, that's the problem. Those are the problems. Donald Trump is not the problem. Donald Trump is simply the litmus test that got put up against it and showed how weak the systems that have been in place for 200 years now are. Problem
is that we don't have a system that, with those things being evident, where intelligent people can get up and say, California didn't get to vote in this process. And, the Republicans have, seeing that they're going to get what they want out of this lunatic, have decided to rubber stamp him for 2 years. And that has been the problem, that there has been no checks and balances against his bad behavior. And now we have the Democrats coming into the House, and, you and I know that the best we can do to silence or to remedy this is, one, create a stalemate, which means nothing gets done, and two, hope that the legal process that is there has an effect, which it well might. But that's the situation we're in right now. And with all due respect, I don't know what any former president could say that would change that situation.
It's leadership. It's getting the American people involved. It's you're right that for a long time Trump was the symptom of a larger cancer, and in many ways still is. Okay, the problem now is that he's exceedingly dangerous, especially with Secretary Mattis having what would have been canned.
It's ridiculous. I want to just jump on that before. The thing is that it's the Republicans that have to wake up, because the rest of the country has gotten it. We got it. We showed up for the midterms, because the midterms, again, that was a miracle that the midterms went to the Democrats at all. I mean, the cards were so stacked against the Democrats winning the House that it is unbelievable. And the only reason it flopped is because that part of the country does get it. But to your point, and the people that I think are really the ones that are the target of what you're rightly saying is the Republicans. It's the Republicans, and their vantage point right now is the Senate. And those people have got to wake the fuck up and see that it is no longer, okay, we've got this guy who is giving us these things on our agenda, so let's play with them. They have played with the devil, and we are all going to go down if they don't get it. And I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. What you were saying, Brody?
Well, I mean, again, I'm predicating it on, political experience and also as a historian. And that office has got so much power right now that, it's people don't understand that there are worst case scenarios, and you've got a nutcase that can start one. And what I was starting to say is when Mattis left, that didn't help matters any. I mean, I don't like the analogy if he was the last adult in the room, but he was the one putting the brakes on wanted abuse of presidential power in ways that could get really nasty really quickly. And you're right, the Republicans aren't doing anything. But at the end of the day, and I've been sitting watching the tweets over the last few hours, Lindsey Graham and some of the rest of them, they're not going to. The Senate is absolutely not going to do anything to put a check on this president. And in the meantime, this president gets more and more and more dangerous. It's setting up for the unthinkable. And that's really what the problem is here. And there is not I'm not out there playing the sky is falling. This is a real thing. This is the real deal. Okay? This guy can start something that may just escalate,
No, yeah, I agree.
My point is Obama, Bush, Clinton have all sat behind the Resolute desk in the Oval, which means those three understand intuitively and through experience the power of that office. And they are the most qualified of anybody I can think of to get out there and say, Danger Will Robinson, there's a serious problem here.
Right.
Well, and I'm not disagreeing that each one of them should absolutely say something. It's kind of I think the fatigue of the country is so much has been said. He has turned it into such an extremist, ridiculous administration. And you're right. There's a danger to, this isn't a comedy. This is a tragedy, And I think, though, the one area I'm kind of hopeful that there are in the state and military that, that he can make some serious mistakes, but not catastrophic ones in those arenas. But the one where I think he is already creating an explosion coming very soon that people are not competent to stop or make statement about, and including the gentleman you talked about, because I don't think they had it all together in this area either. But I really do think Donald Trump is on the verge of tanking our economy. I mean, he has pulled crap and created things economically that are starting to unravel. And when those unravel, it is going to be catastrophic. And it is not going to have to do with foreign powers. It's going to have to do with investments and the economy and the whole domino of all of that. And that process and that system and that infrastructure surprised George W. Bush. It it challenged Barack Obama, and the only one who skated high and pretty on it, although it was starting to come down even under him, was Clinton. And Clinton rode something that was not of his doing. He just kind of lucked out, because that was during the dot-com boom, and it was bubbling up under him, which was not particularly because of his doing. It just, he didn't get in the way of it. But I don't know that the three of them understand how the total effect of it.
But
Donald
the other
Trump
part of it,
poking that bear. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the other part of it too is it's directly relative also in consideration to, looking at the societal and cultural aspects to this, which includes, the LGBTQI community. This administration has, shifted the balance so far over that it's, especially for the trans community. And again, there is a lot of, I think, and I'm hearing this a lot, of last gasp, coming from the evangelical right. And I always keep reminding people that, some animals, when they're wounded and they're cornered, they're even more dangerous.
I agree.
Christian
and,
right.
Well, and I think the effect culturally that he's had that is, and this also might be irreversible, is the discussions and the sensibilities have gone to the next level. We don't have discussions anymore. We have flame wars. We don't build bridges. We try to take out the other side. I mean, I've had so many comments, and well, you and I can make this personal because you were senior editor for a publication called LGBTQ Nation, and I was a weekly contributor there and published very, very regularly. No small part in part to your guidance and help in doing that. But we were both proud to be part of that outlet where discussions were presenting facts and reasonable. And I know my opinion pieces were basically a reasoned discussion with people who were counter to the LGBTQ well-being. And just using that outlet as an example now has turned into yellow journalism. And this is these are on points that I would agree with, but I can't take a lot of the articles there because they're so sensationalistic and overblown in their presentation to be reasonable. And it's not the intention of creating understanding and resolution. It's to inflame. And that's characteristic of the dialogue that's happening in our culture across the board. And that is not a good thing, because when Trump falls, the people who the pendulum swings to step in from the progressive side, they're just going to inflame another Trump in the future if that kind of rhetoric and that kind of positioning is what they take power with. And I mean power in our culture as much as in our government.
I agree. I also think that another huge contributing factor to this is the elephant in the room, and that's social media, in particular Facebook and Twitter. Both of those platforms, Facebook more so than Twitter, I think they have, quite frankly, twisted the narrative, if you will, and in not a very good way, and nor in a very productive way. And they have, I think, in many ways, directly assisted in the creation of the polarity that we see now. You're right. Today, I had an instance on a Facebook post that I put up where I ended up having to zap three or four trolls, which surprised me to no end, is that I am zapping more trolls on the left now than I am on the right.
Right.
And
exactly.
It was like, guys, you know, take five, take a breather. And it was the, you know, impending discussions again as they relitigate 2016 with the, you know, the Beto O'Rourke versus the Joe Biden versus the Bernie Sanders. And I just sat there in dismay. And I ended up yanking the entire post. I just deleted it. It just seemed to attract toxic. It was like it had a neon sign going, ding, 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 ding. Hey, trolls, come here and argue. Oh, by the way, just make sure you're on the left so you can see who's the purest. I mean, I was looking at that, and I'm like, thank God a Trump supporter didn't jump into this. It would really gotten ambitious, you know? Generally speaking, I mean, as I look back at the last year, and I mean, let's face it, we've done 50 weeks of some incredible shows with some incredible people. I will say this publicly. People have actually asked me, well, why don't you guys take calls? And that's me. And it's me because I have to sit there and listen to Washington Week with C-SPAN and listen to the toxicity and the cluelessness coming from the Republican line, the Democratic line, and the Independent line. I'm sorry, I don't have tolerance, nor do I have time for that. I like to have a discussion. I don't need to break out the flamethrowers. And unfortunately, this is what it's turned down to. You know, when you and I bring a guest on, we'd like to hear from the guest. We want to hear their story. We want to hear what they're doing. And we've had some really, really fun guests. And I think that, you know, for the listeners who were expecting part two of the show, yeah, Rob and I kind of walked away from that, but we've got this brilliant, brilliant library of podcasts that you guys are more than welcome to go, you know, listen to. We had some really good shows, you know, but this is it.
Go ahead.
I just look at the clock. Oh, yeah. Well, let's 2019 is going to be a very, very critical year, okay? And I don't say this unkindly, but it's true. Most of the listeners, I think, have figured this out. I'm not an American. I'm Canadian. So 2019 is going to be a very important year for your country. And it's more than just the fact that you guys walked through the midterms and regained one part of your government, but there's going to be a lot more to this. You know, the parasitic thing residing in the Oval Office behind the Resolute Desk, guys, is not going to go away very quickly. There's still a long way to go with that, and there's a long path to go with that. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I don't think impeachment is probably going to be the best way to do it. But there still has to be a way for people to, you know, to be able to work through it. The Democrats are going to have to learn to govern. The Democrats are going to have to do something that they're not good at, and that's getting along. One of the reasons
right.
the Republicans succeed, Rob, and you and I have discussed this, they can stab each other in the back, pour salt in the wound, and still smile as they goose-step down Pennsylvania Avenue, lockstep. Okay? And that's the truth. The right stays on message. This is why the right succeeds. If the left, which is like herding cats in a parade, is going to get to the point where it really needs to be, then people on the left are basically going to have to learn to get along. And it's kind of difficult.
Right.
Because there's a lot of things in the diversity field there that are a little askew. I know this to be true because when I'm talking to my dear friends who are trans, the biggest opposition to trans rights doesn't come from outside of the LGBT acronym. In about 90% of all cases, it comes from within the acronym. And that's tragic. It's trans exclusionary radical feminists who also happen to be lesbian. It's patriotical misogynistic gay guys. It's people that are gay, bisexual, or queer that have the ick factor on the tip of their tongue. You know, that's the type of thing, and that's the kind of nonsense that has to go away. People are going to have to start to learn to see each other as human beings and with value. And unfortunately, as much as the left talks about it, they don't deliver because they're too busy running purity tests on each other. And that's dangerous because that's how Donald Trump's occurred. If you have too many people
right.
running purity tests and about who's the best liberal, you're screwed. Go ahead.
No, totally. Yeah. I do want to touch on our shows for the latter half of the year as promised in the few minutes we have. But yeah. And I do, and to be honest with you, I do see hope in what you've said on the progressive side in the leadership. I think what has kind of transpired around Nancy Pelosi and her meeting with the Progressive Caucus and coming to agreement that she is putting a term limit on herself, should she be the next speaker, is kind of an example of the left, the people in power, doing what you're saying, where they bring issues to the table, compromise, and then walk out together. And so fingers crossed that they take that lesson forward and, move it through the whole agenda. And I think things are going to, what transpires with Donald Trump is going to be very dependent on what next comes out. Because I think that's going to dictate it more than we know and we can project. I do want to touch on some points. And by the way, the themes we talked about tonight, we covered in the last 6 months in different shows.
Yeah, we
so
did.
So we're not
actually,
really
we
that yeah, that off topic. I do want to give a shout out to Bryn Tannehill, who was on several of our shows as our transgender activist, author, and analyst. And her input was very insightful and valuable. We covered quite a few things having to do with transgender youth, from the evil that Betsy DeVos has put upon the country to other issues and challenges that they have had. We actually talked to people that were hugely significant to the point of being iconic in LGBTQ history, including Bishop Gene Robinson and friends and family of Matt Shepard, and the coverage of Matt Shepard being finally laid to rest in the cathedral in Washington, D.C. We also covered some artistic types. We covered Brody Ray, who was a transgender sensation, on America's Got Talent. He was on telling us about his music and career. We also talked to the naked violinist. Did I get that one right?
Oh, the shirtless. The shirtless violinist. Yeah.
wishful thinking on my part.
Yes, is the talents he's brought to YouTube. And the reason I'm going through those is because there are a couple I wanted to ask you for some follow-up, Brody. One, we uncovered and talked about and brought up some follow-up to, which was a hate crime that took place on an Amtrak train. And we actually do have a follow-up to that.
We do have a follow-up and a shout-out to Sonny Torhill and the Salazar family of Denver, Colorado. Aaron Salazar, who was the young 22-year-old that was literally tossed from a train and left for dead, is at a rehabilitation hospital of note in Englewood, Colorado, and he is now speaking. Unfortunately, the damage to his brainstem is such that he has still got limited function and is in a wheelchair, but he's doing much better. He has absolutely denied that that was a suicide attempt on his part. Amtrak police are still maintaining that, you know, the kid did it to himself. There's enough preponderance of evidence contrary. So the family is now working to get the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other law enforcement involved to see if they can actually figure out what really did happen. But Aaron is doing really, really well. He's made, for all intents and purposes, given the severity of his injuries, it's nothing really short of miraculous. And again, I've been in touch with Sonny and Austin, the cousins, who were guests on our show, but Sonia, who lives in Albuquerque, and I communicate frequently, and she says that Aaron is doing really, really well, and the family is actually quite hopeful. So, you know, he unfortunately doesn't remember what happened, and the doctors are saying that that's normal, but there is a possibility, they say, that he may one day suddenly wake up and go, oh my God, this is what happened. So there's that.
Wow. So very good news that he is alive and doing as well as he is. I want to touch on two things that we did cover in the last 6 months. We had shows on each of these and get kind of your feedback on where we are now with those. And one was we covered the Supreme Court's decision on the cake baker in Colorado. What is your thoughts on the aftermath of that?
The decision that was handed down, unfortunately, tilted towards the so-called religious liberties and freedoms momentum that has been established by the Alliance Defending Freedom, Liberty Council, and some of the Thomas More Center, some of these alleged family value Christian. They're basically, for intents and purposes, Christian supremacists. And they do it legalistically, and this pushed things a little bit that way. Now, with Kavanaugh being appointed to the bench, it's going to get a little dicey on religious freedom. The only bright spot on that after the decision is the fact that, and I read the majority, then I read the minority. I think the wild card, believe it or not, is two of them, is the Chief Justice and, believe it or not, Neil Gorsuch. Gorsuch is a constitutional literalist. In other words, he takes and says the document must be literally translated for meaning and so forth. He's one of the ones that kind of falls within the thought process that it's, you know, not a document that grows and matures and ages. And, you know, if this is what's written, then this is the way it's got to be. That being the case, okay, and because the Founding Fathers did have a sense, and the argument, as you saw put forth in the Federalist Papers in particular, between church and state, even to the point during the Treaty of Tripoli, during John Adams' first term of president, where he wrote to the Sultan at Tripoli and said, you know, the United States is not a Christian nation. I think Gorsuch is probably going to be the one, as these other cases come up, that may be the wild card. I don't think we're going to have anything like we have with Justice Kennedy, but I do think that Justice Roberts is going to be more concerned about the legacy he's going to leave behind of the Roberts Court that he's the wild card, and I think that Gorsuch probably may be someone that's not going to be what a lot of the LGBTQ pro ally law firms and other people think he may be. But I definitely believe the Chief Justice will be the wild card. The other part of it is how far they're going to tilt with it and how comfortable the court's going to be with this religious, you know, freedom. And here's where, you know, if you take the gay part of it out of the equation and you take the trans and lesbian and queer part of it out of the equation, that leaves you with, can you discriminate against someone who's Muslim because your religious beliefs are Christian? Can you discriminate
right.
against a Jewish person? So that's really, I think, where the court's going to have a problem with it. And this may be the whole thing about religious beliefs and making cakes for gays, but there's a real slippery slope into other areas, and I think the court may put the brakes on that.
Got it. Yeah. And I think we've seen some of Roberts stepping in, because let's face it, him taking a more moderate view and, exercising that actually does give him a pivotal power in being both Chief Justice and the potential swing vote on all these cases, really gets him into a very historic decision-making position, which, I would think would be attractive. But in our final few minutes here, the other thing we covered this last half was the Kavanaugh hearings, and I think you just gave a great assessment of who is sitting on the court, and obviously he will be as well. But what do you feel like the cultural takeaway from those hearings is going to be?
I think that if anything came out of the Kavanaugh hearings, is that there is a real Achilles heel that was exposed for everyone to take a hard look at. It was initiated by the Me Too movement, but I think that having the good doctor testify before that committee, the questions that were raised, the issues that were now raised, and we're seeing it again in our own community. Kevin Spacey was just charged earlier this week with aggravated sexual assault and battery, which under Massachusetts law is a felony. And there are still other cases on him pending. So I think the takeaway from Kavanaugh is that we are rapidly approaching an era where we may finally see, thankfully, a final neutering of white male privilege, because that is really, at the end of the day, your country's Achilles heel. That and something's got to be done about that. And I think that was probably it. I think people are starting to understand that, you know, that's something that needs to be, you know, put on a box and put up on a shelf and left to collect dust in history bins.
Well said. And I think that's the last story we actually have time to cover this year. So there you go. We are going to have a lot more next year, which coincidentally starts next week, and we're excited to bring it to you. We thank you for your listenership for this year. Stay with us next year for more, bigger, better, brighter, wonderful, exciting, controversial, and the like. I want to thank Brody for his incredible expertise, and all the great subjects and people he has brought on to this show. Kudos, kudos, kudos. I want to also point you to Out in Santa Cruz, Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That is on www.ksco.com. You can hear that show. We will be back again next week, and very excited to do so. We look forward to it. Have a happy new year, and always listen to Rated LGBT Radio.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.